The episode in which the truth is once again revealed that behind all political news is a good economic story. Come on, you know it's true. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risdahl. It is Thursday today, the 10th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There are days, and this is one of them, where the big picture economic news comes couched in geopolitics. Stories in two varieties today, North Korean and Iranian. We'll do the North Koreans first, because President Trump announced today he is going to meet Kim Jong-un on June the 12th in Singapore. There are, of course, a whole lot of variables in this equation. What is motivating whom to do what? One of the things that may well have driven the North Korean leader to the negotiating table is the state of his country's economy. So we asked Marketplace's Sabri Benishore to find out how bad it might really be.
They call North Korea the Hermit Kingdom for a reason. It's not exactly easy to see what's happening with its economy. One way to guess is to look at trade data reported by its biggest trading partner, China.
North Korean exports are down really sharply, down 90% from a year ago levels.
Bill Brown is an adjunct professor at Georgetown School of Foreign Service. After a series of missile launches last year, China stopped buying North Korean items like coal and textiles, which showed up in the Chinese data. Not everybody trusts China's numbers on North Korea, but Brown says he mostly does.
Almost more interesting, their imports from China also were falling sharply, down about half. That's telling you they're really running out of money.
But the picture's mixed. Scott Snyder is senior fellow for Korea Studies for the Council on Foreign Relations.
So far, we've seen anecdotal reports of gas shortages inside North Korea, but we really haven't seen dramatic spikes in the price of staples or everyday goods.
Lisa Collins with the Center for Strategic and International Studies says it's telling that there's a lot of economic activity we do not see.
Counterfeiting U.S. dollars, smuggling drugs, selling other illegal goods around the world.
But despite all we cannot see, North Korea remains one of the poorest countries in the world. And many observers suspect that the tightening sanctions over the past year likely played some role in the regime's recent engagement. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The geopolitical offlead of this Thursday is Iran and the nuclear deal to which the United States is no longer a party. It's not like that decision came as much of a surprise. The president telegraphed his intentions during the campaign. But now that push has come to shove, America's European allies, who wanted the president to stick with the deal and lobbied him hard on that, are stuck. The United States is going to reimpose sanctions on Iran and on companies, European companies included, that do business there. So, from the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports on what the EU might do next.
For European businesses, billions of dollars worth of trade are at stake. Airbus is supplying Iran with 100 planes. French oil giant Total is involved in a $4 billion project. Renault in a joint venture to make 150,000 cars a year. Aga Demaret of the Economist Intelligence Unit says the EU will hold fast to the deal with Iran.
This means that the EU, of course, will try to help EU companies operating in Iran to maintain their business operations there.
To fend off punitive American sanctions, the EU could revive its so-called blocking regulation, EC number 2271/96. Introduced more than two decades ago, it was designed to protect European companies from American sanctions against Cuba. In this case, it would make it illegal for European firms to comply with any new U.S. sanctions against Iran. But, says Sanam Vakil of the Chatham House think tank, that would force companies into a no-brainer decision. Who do you want to do business with, the U.S. or Iran?
The U.S. market is much larger than the Iranian market and with much less risk, and the choice will be rather obvious.
The EU could go for broke and launch counter-sanctions against the U.S., but, says Luigi Scattieri of the Centre for European Reform in Brussels, that, coupled with the tensions over steel tariffs, would risk an all-out transatlantic trade war.
We have to remember that this is taking place in a broader context. My guess is that the Europeans won't really be willing to take much action.
How much action the Europeans will take may become clearer next Monday when foreign ministers are slated to meet with the Iranians here in London. I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, you can thank a nice mellow report on consumer inflation for the rally. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. So here's a number from the Federal Reserve that'll make this next item resonate with you a little bit. According to a report from the Fed out yesterday, the total amount of outstanding student debt in America hit $1.5 trillion in the first quarter of 2018. $1.521 trillion to be precise. So with that in mind, then, here is the item. Mick Mulvaney, the acting director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, is doing a reorg of sorts. He's folding the student loan division, the office meant to protect all those student borrowers, into a different unit focused on more general consumer education. Marketplace's Rima Kreis explains what that might mean in practice.
All right, so what's the big deal here? Folding one office into another sounds like a mundane bureaucratic move.
The reorganization means it's less likely that there'll be somebody in Washington keeping an eye on the student loan debt collection industry to make sure that they're treating customers fairly.
Christopher Peterson is a former enforcement lawyer at the CFPB. He calls this reorganization sneaky. The student arm of the agency is known to sift through complaints from consumers, point at violations, take legal action. Now that it'll be folded into the Office of Financial Education,
they'll probably write some pamphlets and put some web content up. Providing education is very important, but it's not quite the same thing as holding banks and other financial companies accountable when they break the law.
Over the years, the division has clawed back $750 million from lenders. And last year, it sued Navient, the country's largest student loan company. Whitney Barclay-Denny of the Center for Responsible Lending says this change shifts oversight responsibility.
If nobody on the federal level is willing to do their job and protect students and borrowers, the states are going to have to step in and do it for them.
A spokesperson for the CFPB says the move is very modest, that there's no practical change. James Copeland, a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, says reactions by critics are overblown.
The question here is to give the students who are potential borrowers more information rather than trying to micromanage a complicated market.
A complicated and growing market. Student loans are now the biggest category of borrowing after mortgages. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
There's arguably no foreign leader who's tried harder to get into President Trump's good economic graces than Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. But all the photo ops and visits to Mar-a-Lago haven't done him much good. Japanese steel and aluminum exporters are among the relative few who actually wound up having to pay the president's tariffs. What gives? Chioko Goto is with the Asia program at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the nuts and bolts, do me a favor and give me an overview of the U.S.-Japanese economic relationship, would you?
The U.S.-Japan economic relationship isn't what it used to be 20 years ago. 20 years ago, it used to be that of friction. They were on the verge of or in the midst of a trade war at any given time. And there was a lot of concern about Japan really overtaking the global economy. That is certainly no longer the case. So what is happening now, though, the Trump administration is really focused on reducing the bilateral trade deficit. Shinzo Abe has really tried very hard to ingratiate Japan to the United States, and it also wants the United States to be part of a multilateral free trade agreement.
So with that in mind, then, with Prime Minister Abe wanting multilateral relationships and President Trump being emphatic about bilateral trade deals being the way he's going to do business, where's the opportunity for compromise?
The compromise can really be on focusing on what may unite them. The big one is China, and the concern about China and its trade practices, especially in stealing intellectual property. Japan's really trying to have the current administration focus on those issues, but it's been a really hard struggle for them. So people are looking for results, and the results just haven't been there.
And here we have then, speaking of results, the Japanese being subjected to these steel and aluminum tariffs when basically everybody else, except maybe the Chinese, are getting these exemptions.
Right. And this has been greatly disappointing to Tokyo. Abe and Trump met at Mar-a-Lago. They played golf. The expectation was that, yes, Japan has this very strong personal relationship with Trump that would translate into at least equal treatment of Japan with the European Union or Australia. But no, it's actually been treated in the way that Russia and Turkey are. So
Well, how much longer do you think Abe can keep going to Trump and Trump basically saying, yeah, talk to the hand, and Abe going home with nothing, right?
Prime Minister Abe currently is having a lot of trouble back home as well. He is facing a lot of discontent from the opposition on cronyism. So he really needs to bring home some kind of tangible result. So in the case of steel, the Japanese strategy from here on out is going to be to continue to press for exemption, but also to try to get exemptions line by line, item by item on each steel and aluminium thing. The other strategy that the Japanese want is, of course, to have the United States part of a multilateral agreement like the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, or if failing that, at least to avoid having to negotiate a bilateral trade agreement with the United States.
Shihoko Goto, she's a senior Northeast Asia associate at the Woodrow Wilson Center, the Asia program there. Shihoko, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Coming up.
Everyone is very well aware of all the things that are not working at the national level. There's essentially no news value there.
But what about the places where things are working, huh? What about them? We'll tell you. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 0.8% today, 196 points, 24,739. The NASDAQ gained 0.8%, 65 points, 7404. S&P 500 up 0.9%, 25 points, 2773. The FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, says June the 11th is when net neutrality goes away. Thus, internet service providers did fine. Thank you. AT&T up 1.5%. Verizon boosted 1.7%. Comcast up 2.7% today. Apple and Goldman Sachs are going to launch a joint credit card. That's according to the Wall Street Journal. On that news, Apple shined up 1.4%. Goldman Sachs deposited 0.7%. Visa up 0.1%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.96%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There are across the country right now more than 2,300 families that left Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria living in what's called transitional shelter assistance. That's a FEMA program that puts evacuees in hotels temporarily. That living in hotels part comes to an end soon. It started last October. FEMA says TSA, as it's known, will end on June the 30th, leaving those 2,300 families without a place to live. From Kissimmee, Florida, Marketplace's Renata Sago reports that that lack of affordable housing is the biggest problem for a lot of Puerto Rican evacuees.
Hector Martinez has been staying in a hotel room at the downtown Kissimmee Ramada since November. His bathroom sink now doubles as his kitchen faucet, and his television stand's been transformed into a cupboard.
I have everything here to cook. I got food over there. I make my food in the microwave.
This kind of improvisation is a skill he's picked up since evacuating the Puerto Rican municipality of Toa Baja. It was badly damaged by Hurricane Maria last September. Martinez, his wife, and two teenage sons had been renting a house there. They lost furniture and clothes, but Martinez says the toughest part was struggling for 2 months after the hurricane to get food, water, and gas.
We had all day to find one supermarket that you can buy food. You make that long line, like a 2 or 3 hour under sums to get something to eat.
When Martinez's hours got cut at work and his wife lost her job, he decided to come to Florida alone to find a place for them all to stay. In the meantime, his wife and kids are still living in their apartment in Toa Baja.
My heart got broken when my family sent me text, "We don't have power today." That's hard for me.
Martinez has been working 2 on-call jobs doing cleaning and maintenance. That gets him about $300 a week. He also drives Uber sometimes. All this to cover daily living expenses and to send money to his wife and sons.
I do everything for bringing my family to here.
Martinez has been able to stay in his hotel thanks to FEMA. The agency's Transitional Shelter Assistance Program, called TSA, reimburses hotels in Kissimmee $129 a day to house evacuees. TSA has spent more than $70 million nationwide since it started in October.
They're getting ready. They know that this is going to end.
Ana Cruz with the City of Orlando's Hispanic Office for Local Assistance has been helping about 150 Puerto Rican evacuees a month since they began arriving in Central Florida.
This is what, when they come here.
Cruz and her staff tell them it's hard to find an affordable place to stay. So if you have friends or family, see if you can live with them for at least 3 months. In this part of Florida, the median rent starts at a little under $1,100 a month.
The ones at the hotels, we try to sell them, look for a job right away.
Now, there are many jobs in Central Florida, especially in the hospitality industry, and companies have been hiring evacuees. Churches, nonprofits, and county government will even pay the first month's rent for families. But some of the obstacles include requirements for renters. They need good credit, proof of past rental, and a permanent job, or Cruz says, at least 4 pay stubs.
And they would have maybe 2.
This is also a region where developers are catering to wealthy snowbirds and buyers from Brazil, Canada, and China. And the affordable housing market is challenging right now, says Florida Congressman Darren Soto.
So it's beyond just the evacuees. We have residents who are still struggling, too.
FEMA recently announced it'll pay for flights back to Puerto Rico for families in transitional shelter on the mainland. The agency says it'll also help them find new apartments on the island if their homes were badly damaged and insurance won't fully cover their losses. But Hector Martinez doesn't plan on returning to Puerto Rico.
I want to get an apartment, you know.
He'd need at least $3,000 for a security deposit and first month's rent to get that apartment. If he has to leave the hotel before he finds a 2-bedroom so his family can join him, he says he'll live in his truck. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
Something like 5 years ago now, we did a series of stories with James Fallows, the national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. He and his wife, Deborah, would fly around the country in their own small private plane to the cities and towns that people don't usually talk about very much. We would go along or meet them someplace and just talk to people to see how things were going away from the national dysfunction. We went with them to Sioux Falls and Columbus, Mississippi, Eastport, Maine as well. Jim and Deb went to many, many more places and have told the tale of those travels in their new book. It's called Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. It's really good to have you both here.
Thank you, Kai.
I'm going to start, actually, Deb, with you. And this observation, which is about how you start the book, you start with leaving Washington on the way out here to L.A. and Southern California to write this thing. It's almost, you started at the end, kind of.
Yeah, that was a big moment. We were leaving in the winter of 2017, heading for, once again, beautiful Southern California, taking a southerly route across the U.S. to get into the proper mood to tell this story right of all the things that we had seen across the country.
Jim, give me the, the airman's perspective on this. Why, other than you enjoying flying around in your plane, why do this reporting this way?
I guess, to be honest, there are a couple reasons. One is, I just love doing this. The view you have of a nation with no state borders and no political boundaries, but you can see why cities are where they are. It's also the case that over time, the most interesting thing to us, and what we wanted to convey, was direction. You know, some places you can imagine they're making it, others not. But I think the sense of where people felt their communities, their businesses, their lives were leading them, that became more and more fascinating to us.
Here comes then, Jim, the okay but wait question. Because as you have written and as we see in the newspapers every day and read and hear on radio and television and in all of our, you know, public consumption of news, things are fraught, if not fractured, at the national level. And the thesis of this book is, in essence, the heck with the national level. There are cities and towns in this country that are making it work, and we need to pay attention to that.
Yes, that would be a good summary you might consider a career as an interviewer. So I think that the complex but not too complex message we're trying to get across is that everyone is very well aware of all the things that are not working at the national level. There's essentially no news value there. What people seem to us to be insufficiently aware of is how much the local progress that most people reported had its analogs all across the rest of the country, that most places we went, they felt like, well, here in Mississippi, we're getting our new steel factory, we're getting our ways to train people, but I assume they're not doing that every place else. And our sense was that most people felt much better about the part of the world they could directly experience than the one they just heard about. And so making people realize it wasn't just these islands of some forward movement, that's essentially our message.
Deb, a word here about civic institutions. And I should say here, you two, by the time you'd done this a couple of cities worth, you had a pretty set methodology, right? Jim would go and do his thing with economic development and you know, other folks, and you would go and check out schools and libraries and language training centers in places with lots of immigrants. Talk to me for a second about how those civic institutions fold into the rise of these communities.
Yeah. So when we went to these towns, Jim and I would usually start out by going to see the mayor or the city manager and the newspaper editor and get a little bit of a sense of what was going on in town. And then we would split up and go in our different directions. And I would head for a public school or a charter school and to the library and to the recreation centers, places like that, that were the public institutions of the town. And what was very interesting to learn about these was how these public institutions had their fingers on the pulse of the heart and soul of those communities and where they could collaborate together to speak to the wants and needs and kind of fill in the gaps and make their cities grow and thrive and all work together.
Jim, you two end this book with a list of 10 and a half signs of civic success. We'll get to the half in a minute. But I want to point out a couple of them and then ask you about one specifically. They work together on local possibilities. You say they ignore national politics, public-private partnerships. They have downtowns, which is helpful. Number nine is they make themselves open when it comes to immigration, which is, I think, a really interesting thing, especially about after our experience in South Dakota in Sioux Falls.
Yes. And you recall early in this journey when we were together in Sioux Falls, I think we were all surprised, and Deb and I didn't really know how to put it in perspective then, that there were all of these refugees working in the pork slaughtering house there.
Yeah.
And at just the time when our national level has become more polarized on this precise issue, you hear those build-a-wall rallies in places where there are no foreigners. The places, by and large, where outsiders are arriving, they are being absorbed in the way that has been the case through our history, which is to say it's never perfect, it's never entirely easy, but it happens. And we saw that in South Dakota and in Kansas, Dodge City, Kansas, majority Latino now. And we saw it in Michigan. We saw it around the country.
You also say they have to have educational facilities, Jim. Number 10 is they have to have big plans, be ambitious. And then 10 and a half, and this is a little tongue-in-cheek, but it's kind of real, they have a brewery.
It is true. And this was, again, a point of personal privilege to begin with. I love craft beer, and so I'm glad to see it spread, which is now to all 50 states. But it's become a real economic thing. As you've discussed in your show, it's an actual employment center now with hundreds of thousands of employees in this industry across the country. We were just recently in Duluth, where a brewery called Bent Paddle is essentially the anchor for an old industrial part of town reviving. So, yes, 10 and a half, the half I have special fondness for.
One more interesting thing about the Bent Paddle, which we hadn't seen in other microbreweries. The Bent Paddle had a separate kind of community gathering room that they turned over on several nights out of the week for civic groups or organizations to come have their meetings. So they're kind of vying with the public library to be a community center as well.
Common spaces, right? I mean, that's a real thing.
That's right.
Yeah. James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic Magazine. Deborah Fallows, his wife and a linguist, and both of them the authors of a new book called Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thanks,
Kai. Thank you, Kai.
you want to see and hear some of the places we went with Jim and Deb Fallows and their Cirrus SR22, we've collected a bunch of them at our website, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which we return you to your regularly scheduled global trade programming. You remember NAFTA and how it's either dead or going to be renegotiated, depending on how President Trump is feeling that particular day? While we are in the, I think, eighth round of renegotiation meetings this week, House Speaker Paul Ryan has decided to focus everybody's mind. The speaker said this today, quote, "We have to have the paper, not just an agreement. We have to have the paper from USTR, the U.S. Trade Representative, by May the 17th, end of quote. That's the Speaker of the House today. And that's in order to get a congressional vote on the thing this year. And it is, I'm obliged to point out, in a week. All right, we got to go a little tight on time. Markets were up today. Let's just leave it at that. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Danielle Irby, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.